From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in today for Kodwo Nnamdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4, a columnist for the Current newspapers, and he is one half of the reporting team that wrote the greatest and best book in the history of DC, local DC politics, Dream City, Race, Power, and the Decline of Washington, D.C., but you've updated that title.
Yes,
since, right?
I was going to point out, you had the old edition, the 1994 edition. 2014, Harry and I came out with a new edition that carries the reader all the way through the Muriel Bowser election.
No, I have the 1994 edition, which has this incredible jacket photo of Tom Sherwood in 1994 with a mustache and a great pair of glasses.
That's my film noir look.
We are honored to be here. We are honored that in the studio here with us today is the other half of that dream reporting team. Harry Jaffe is an editor-at-large at Washingtonian Magazine, who has an article out in this month's edition about race and policing in the District of Columbia. We're going to talk more about that later. But Harry Jaffe, thanks so much for making time for us today.
Excited to be here sitting with my partner?
Well, colleagues in crime.
Well, we've got some serious news to talk about, but first I know that there's one issue that's near and dear to Tom Sherwood's heart, and that's that every summer, the first day of pools open in the District of Columbia, you feel very strongly that the mayor of the district, whoever that person is, should do this.
Cannonball!
That's correct. You know, this is, you know, the city's really gone downhill as much as it's done well. When Tony Williams was mayor back in the late 90s and early 2000s, the pools had never been opened on time. It was a nightmare. He got the recreation department fixed. And to show how great it was, he'd start the summer by doing a cannonball into the pool. Not one mayor since has had the nerve to follow in his footsteps on the diving board. It's an outrage. It should be disqualifying for the mayors if they don't do the cannonball.
I'm with you on this 100%. Harry Jaffe, how do you feel? Do you agree with us?
I think that Mayor Williams was oddly perfectly suited for that, because nobody would expect him unless he wore his bow tie. But he was making a statement, and I think that he was noting the change that had come about in the decrepit pool. So I think it was timely for him. I of course disagree with Sherwood that it's required of every single mayor.
Well, of course you would disagree, but the fact is the recreation centers in the city have been rebuilt over the series of mayors, beginning with Tony Williams, which is the good news. The pools are open. They open on time. They have lifeguards. They're clean. It is a good thing. We just should have the cannonball.
I will make a bet right now, $50, that Mayor Bowser will not do the cannonball.
No, she's refused to do it.
Okay, well,
I won't take that bet against you, but I hope she does, because I think that everybody benefits when the mayor of our city is
next
is
year.
Cannonball.
Private citizen Barack Obama will do the cannonball to open the pools for the city.
Ooh, that would be fantastic.
That would be good.
So let's talk about a bit of breaking news this morning. We learned something about the sentencing of the businessman Jeff Thompson, who pleaded guilty two years ago to
the,
corrupting the
campaign.
Election that put Vincent Gray into office. What's going to happen, Tom?
Well, the prosecutors just announced within the hour that the sentencing date for Jeffrey Thompson to find out how much time he would do for his crimes was put off from June 10th to the month of August. Why is that important? June 10th is just 4 days before the city's Democratic primary on June 14th, Tuesday, where Vincent Gray, the former mayor who was sunk by the shadow campaign as to run for reelection, is trying to restart his political career in Ward 7 by opposing Yvette Alexander. Had there been the sentencing on June 10th, there would be sentencing memoranda out with even more details about the shadow campaign, which many people thought would embarrass Vince Gray. So this is good news for him that's been put off.
I totally agree. It does not allow the Washington Post to once again beat up the former mayor for not being indicted in that long time investigation. Every time the Post gets a chance in the news pages or in the editorial pages, it beats up Vince Gray. So taking it off the table, postponing it, I think is a huge boon for him, and I think it's better for the city as well.
And that primary is on June 14th. There's an at-large race with Vincent Orange and Robert White and David Garber. We spoke to them last week. Races in Ward 8 and in Ward 4. We'll be keeping plenty of track of that. But
that
speaking
Ward
of,
7 was a huge one.
Speaking of everybody in the city kind of getting beaten up this week, the House of Representatives voted on Wednesday to nullify a D.C. ballot measure that allowed the city to spend its local tax dollars without congressional approval. Kodjo, when I'm not here, when you're here with Kodjo week after week, he has a phrase that he likes to use to describe the members of Congress who kick around the District of Columbia, the pond scum interloper dictators.
Yes.
How do you guys feel about it?
Well, as a reporter, I understand what the issue is. As a citizen of the city, I think the district citizens ought to have, like other cities and states in the country, the ability to spend their local tax dollars without interference. Since Home Rule began, here's the short history. Since Home Rule began in 1974, the city has had to send its annual budget to the president, who then submits it to Congress as if it were another government agency, the Veterans Department, Agriculture, Interior, whatever. And then the Congress would kick it around with the federal budget and then finally pass it. Many years, our budget, the city budget, gets tied up in the knots in Capitol Hill. So the city tried to figure out a way to say, look, for at least spending our own tax dollars, which is about $9 billion out of the $13 billion, we'll just treat it as a regular bill. Every bill the city passes has to sit before Congress for 30 days. If Congress doesn't act on it, it becomes law. And that's what the city has moved to do. The Republicans say, oh, no, you can't change it. We can change it. You can't change it. So they have a bill that passed the Republican House this week saying you must follow the rules as they have been in place since Home Rule began. Now Eleanor Holmes Norton is trying to fight this in the Senate. Obama's administration has said he will threaten to veto. He didn't say will. He threatened to veto if this bill passes. But even if it doesn't pass, they're going to attach it to some must-spending bill going forward. And it may be that this city plan to independently spend its local tax dollars will bite the dust.
Barry Jaffe, what did you make of what happened this week?
I find this perhaps the most offensive action of Congress, because as a resident of the district, I pay taxes on my property, and that should go for things that the elected officials in the District of Columbia think is best for the schools, for the roads, for the police. Why should a senator or a congressman from Kansas or North Carolina or California have any jurisdiction and say over my personal tax dollars? I think that's just, there's no justice in that. There's no democracy in that.
Well, the Republicans say very simply, the Constitution of the United States of America says that the Congress shall have full legislative authority over the district. Now, some of the Republicans agree that we could give them the right to spend their own money, but it's Congress's role to run the city, and that's what they're doing.
We're going to talk to a Republican in just a moment, but if you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 800-433-8850. You can tweet us at Kodjo Show or simply email us at kodjo@wamu.org. Harry Jaffe, you're about to say something, then we're going to go to our first guest.
Well, I think that just things have changed in the district since the Constitution was written. It was a small, literally a federal enclave to just basically house the seat of government, and a city has grown around it. With taxpayers and people who have needs of public education, public health, public safety. And I think that the Constitution needs to be adjusted, frankly.
Well, we've adjusted the Constitution for a lot of serious things, including the treatment of African Americans and the right for women to vote and whether we can drink booze or not. There are lots of reasons to change the Constitution, and it should be changed. But the fact is as of this moment, the Constitution gives that authority to the Congress, and the lobbying has to be done to change the will of Congress, not just to do it in spite of Congress.
Let's go to a guest who's joining us by phone. Jim Lemunyan is a member of the Virginia House of Delegates. He's a Republican whose district includes parts of Fairfax and Loudoun counties. Jim Lemunyan, thanks so much for making time for us today.
Happy to be here. Good afternoon.
I want to ask you about an issue that is going to affect everybody in our region, and that's Metro's SafeTrack maintenance plan that's about to get underway next week. Before we get into anything else, What's this going to mean for Northern Virginia, and are there plans to address the transportation challenges that are going to come with everything that's going to happen?
Yeah, are you guys getting ready?
Yeah, it's long overdue, and that's why there's going to be more of a inconvenience now than there would have been when we should have done this maybe as far back as 10 years ago. But I think, certainly speaking for myself, and I think most elected officials that I know in Northern Virginia, you know, we're behind Paul Wiedefeld, we're behind the Metro Board to do what it needs doing to get the safety problems fixed. I mean, they're not going to get better with time. They're only going to get worse. So we've got to step up and do it.
This is Tom Scherbitzer. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Segment of Safe Track is June 4th to June 16th. Continuous single tracking from Boston to East Falls Church. Are the local governments, you represent, I realize it's the state assembly, but are the local governments going to be prepared for alternative gap busing or for traffic control so that people can get around? My fear is that people are simply going to abandon Metro and go to their cars and be even more of a mess in Northern Virginia and downtown D.C.
Yeah, and that's I think people are prepared for that, but at the end, you just don't know how many people are going to say, "I'm gonna take the car and not ride the train." As a practical matter, on that particular segment that you mentioned, we're almost kind of used to it, particularly on weekends. I mean, I've taken the train down to downtown on the weekends for a Nats game or something like that, and it seems like a third to half the time they're already single track because they're doing one kind of maintenance or another. So
why does the Silver Line have to be single tracked? It's brand new.
Well, it's East Falls Church Station and into D.C. That is a Silver Line track. That's where the Silver Line connects. I'm not aware of any single tracking of the Silver Line west of the East Falls Church Station because that is new track.
Okay. Delegate Lemunyan, where do you think teleworking should fit into all of this?
Teleworking is a great idea. It's certainly something that's been incentivized at the state level here in Virginia from a tax standpoint. The federal government's done that as well. I think more than just the tax incentives, people have just done this naturally, and it's not just local commuting. It's the internet based. You can now get real time people on a screen and actually have a meeting. I do these things quite frequently myself. It just saves a lot of time altogether. So we'll see whether we'll see how inconvenient these single tracking events are and how people react. This will be the first one, probably be an indicator of other things to come over the next several months and actually years that this is going to take place.
Your Democratic Governor McAuliffe this week said he threatened to withhold money from Metro if the state would withhold money from Metro if it didn't get busy on getting the safety commission in place. I'm not sure threatening to withhold money from Metro is a good idea since that's exactly what Metro needs. But what do you think about that?
Well, we've done that, made those threats before. The fact is, and it's a little complicated the way it works, it's actually the local governments in Northern Virginia that are legally on the hook to subsidize Metro, and the state backs that up by basically replacing those dollars. And so if the state says we're not gonna pay, we're basically leaving the jurisdictions in Northern Virginia out the dry. We're not really leaving Metro out the dry.
Could you really shut, if you didn't allow the local governments to pay for Metro operating costs, I don't think they can go into debt to do it. It seems to me it would just be a devastating blow to Metro.
Yeah, now that's you're right. That's not a way to go. Now, to the point, though, Metro does have some issues financially separate from its safety issue. The safety issues are going to take money to fix, but if you compare the operations of Metro to other comparable transit systems in the United States, which would in particular be Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, I mean, Metro is operating at substantially higher expenses, whether you measure it by per passenger mile, per vehicle hour, or whatever the standard metrics are. Somebody's got to reckon with that. Because otherwise there's never going to be enough money to fund Metro. And I don't understand why we have to operate substantially higher, when I say that, between, say, 25% and 50% higher operating costs than these other systems. There's just never going to be a tax increase or a fare card increase to cover that kind of thing, and we've got to get that fixed.
Tom, I'm glad you brought up Governor McAuliffe, because there's another issue I want to ask about right now, and that's that Republicans filed suit this week to block the governor's executive order that would restore voting rights to felons in Virginia. What are the concerns among you and your fellow party members?
Well, a number of things. We have a process in Virginia to restore civil rights to felons when they finish their prison terms. It's on a case-by-case basis. And the point that we made in the lawsuit, among others, is we think that's what the state constitution requires. And so that's the legal point, is whether you do this in one fell swoop, which in this case affects 206,000 felons, 40,000 or so convicted of violent crimes, that without an individual review, not only get their voting rights restored, they are allowed to serve on juries, and as the Washington Post reported, I think within the last week, it's easier for them to get their gun rights back. And we felt that that's something you do on a case-by-case basis. Now, reasonable people can agree or disagree that that process should be going faster, but the problem you have with executive orders, not just this one and this specific topic, is you don't have public hearings in advance. This was something that was not, you know, nobody, at least on the Republican side, saw coming. It happened 36 hours after the last day of our session in Richmond. And when you have public hearings, when you use the legislative process, these kind of points get vetted. And you say, well, okay, we'll give him the voting rights back, but you really want this guy sitting on a jury. We'll give him the voting rights back, but you really want this guy owning a gun. And what about restitution? Okay, people will now get voting rights back and still owe restitution to victims. Well, when did the victims get their voice in this process?
Here's Harry Jaffe from Washington, and he has a question for you.
Hi, I'd like to switch to politics, pure politics, for a second.
You don't think some of this is politics? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you. So my wife is from Clark County, Virginia, which is in the 10th district just to the west of yours. And sure. Barbara Comstock is a Republican who first termed congresswoman. Do you see your district changing demographically, politically, so to the point where Barbara Comstock is going to have a difficult time running as a Republican, or do you think that that she'll be able to hold the seat? And also for yourself, are you threatened by the fact, or are you adjusting to the fact that your district is changing demographically?
Yeah, I think the changes demographically occurred much more in the 2000 to 2010 period than they have in the last 5 years. And Congresswoman Comstock's district overlaps my legislative district by about 95%.
Right.
But one of the reasons for that is, at least my part of the world, the land use is built out. There's just not a lot of new construction, and the base of the population is relatively stable. So
but the growth around Leesburg, though, is not necessarily Republicans. I think that you're having a lot of immigrants, Indians, Latinos who are coming into that into the district, and they are not necessarily Republican. Does that concern you?
Well, that Leesburg is not part of my particular district, but my district, according to the latest census data, 23% of the people were born in a foreign country. So I'm quite familiar with and quite comfortable in working with people who come here from all around the world, and I'm happy that they do. Many of these people are big successes in business and are creating a better life for everyone, not just themselves. And I don't necessarily assume that people are not Republicans if they are of a different ethnicity or come here from a foreign country.
Many of them are in fact conservative. They're family oriented. They have all the attributes of the American country likes to talk about. But you have a presidential candidate, the presumed nominee Donald Trump, who seems to be going out of his way to irritate immigrants. I mean, just recently talking about even the governor of New Mexico is not an immigrant. But the whole issue about are you guys with Northern Virginia changing so much? Tom Davis, former congressman, likes to say Northern Virginia looks more like New Jersey. than it does the old Dominion. Is the Republican Party going to be able to change so you don't get wiped out demographically?
Well, we certainly need to change our tone related to immigration, okay? I mean, immigration is what has made this country great. Legal immigration is very important, okay? And I think if there's a distinction to be made, it's between a process where people come here legally versus people who want to crash the gate. And
build the wall?
No, the wall's not going to work. But you know, we have let this fester for years and years and years. The last big immigration reform bill was in 1984, and frankly, it didn't work. And so Congress has got to step up and fix that. But just my own personal story, I started a company 15 years ago in a technology business in Northern Virginia, and two of the four co-founders were from a foreign country. I mean, whatever success I've had in business in the course of my life wouldn't have happened without immigrants.
You sound like a reasonable Republican. You could be in danger.
I'm very reasonable.
We're talking with Jim Lemunyan. He's a member of the Virginia House of Delegates.
Oh, you hear that? He says he does cannonballs.
Yeah.
Oh, well, then maybe you can run for District of Columbia mayor sometime. We can get you doing cannonball. That's Jim Lemunyan. He's a member of the Virginia House of Delegates. He's a Republican whose district includes parts of Fairfax and Loudoun counties. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 800-433-8850. You can tweet us at Kojo Show. I'm Michael Martinez, sitting in for Kojo today. You're listening to the Politics Hour, where we're always joined by Tom Sherwood, our resident analyst, a reporter for NBC4. And today we're joined by Harry Jaffe, editor-at-large at Washingtonian. And there was some other political news in Virginia this week. The Supreme Court left a lower court's decision in place that redrew Virginia's congressional districts. And the ruling was seen as a win for Democrats, but the issue of gerrymandering is kind of an equal opportunity sport in Virginia and everywhere else. What did you make of how the Supreme Court ruled in this case?
Well, I don't think it certainly wasn't a surprise for me. I think that a lot of people have anticipated that, and candidates have lined up to run in this year's election based on that change. And I'm not aware that there's something more coming in terms of a challenge to Virginia's redistricting. One thing I will say is I would hope that Congress would step in and maybe speak more clearly to the federal law aspect of how district lines could be drawn, because so much of redistricting law is case law. And as a state legislator who's responsible for establishing these districts, both for congressional districts as well as the state legislative districts, it's nearly impossible to read through all that and try to interpret it and get it right.
Mr. Lemunyan, this is the Politics Hour. You're a successful business person. I think you've done pretty well since, 2009 in the General Assembly. Do you anticipate that you'll run for Congress or some other statewide office in Virginia, Commonwealth?
Well, I have no plans to do that at the moment. You know, my attitude is to do a good job at what I'm doing now, and if the good Lord opens some doors for me, great. If not, I'm not going to try to pick the lock or bang down the door.
What about going to Cleveland for the Republican convention? Will I see you there?
I think I'll be on the beach.
That sounds pretty good. Well, while we've got you here on the phone, I want to ask you one last question.
Sure.
And that's that Governor McAuliffe is dealing with now a federal investigation into campaign contributions and his personal finances. This was reported by CNN earlier this week, and it involves questions around a statute regulating U.S. citizens lobbying on behalf of foreign governments. We don't know much about what's going on at this point, and it's still really a matter of what's being reported in news media. But how did you react to the news, and what do you think is at stake and how this plays out?
Well, I know nothing more than what's been reported in the news. I hope there's nothing there, and I hope whatever the Justice Department is looking at gets cleared up quickly and we drive on. Anytime there's a question mark that's raised, for you know, rightfully or wrongly, over an elected official's head, it just slows down the process of governing one way or another, and you know, it raises questions among the public about whether the people they elect are really working for them or something else. So I hope there's nothing there, and I hope we get past it quickly.
And soon we'll know about Governor McDonnell in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, that's decision. Supreme Court usually wraps up by the end of June, so that's coming pretty soon.
Well, thank you so much for making time for us, Delegate Lemunyan. Enjoy your time at the beach, and maybe next time we'll see you in the studio.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for including me.
All right. Take care.
Can you do a cannonball? At the beach, I guess you have to be in the pool.
I think you can do it off of a dock. right?
That might be good.
We can do that. We can put it up on YouTube.
Sure, but I think you should just do it yourself.
You're Mr.
Call it a day.
I've never
social
been
media.
Asked.
Tom,
well,
Tom,
you just consider yourself asked.
That was Jim LaMunyan. He is a member of the Virginia House of Delegates, a Republican who represents parts of Fairfax and Loudoun counties. And it just got a whole lot more crowded here in the studio.
That's not a swipe at our size.
We are now joined in the studio by Kathy Lanier, Chief of the Metropolitan Police Department in the District of Columbia. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
We're also joined in the studio by Lowell Duckett. He is a former lieutenant in the Metropolitan Police Department who once led the D.C. Black Police Caucus. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And the reason why all of these people are here is an article that Harry wrote for this month's Washingtonian that focuses on how the D.C. police force is changing. And like the city itself, it's getting whiter. What were you writing about?
Well, as a city resident, I keep in touch with just, you know, what's going on around me. I'm a journalist, and I kept seeing, frankly, just a lot more Caucasian faces behind the wheels in a scout car responding to, police situations around where I live at 15th and Swan. And it occurred to me that there's something going on. And then I looked into the data and, in fact, saw that according to the MPD's annual reports, the number of African-American officers hit a high point of 67%, I believe, in the early 90s.
98.
And thank you. And it's now down to 55% and kind of plummeting pretty quickly. And the number of white officers is on the rise. And then I did some interviewing. And, what I heard from sources of mine who are active duty police officers is that, it's a factor in their policing. Sometimes good, sometimes not so good. But what I heard from the chairman of the city council and Chief Lanier is that the added factor is that a lot of the new officers are not from Washington, D.C., and that can exacerbate the problem of policing in the District of Columbia if you come from North Carolina, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Kansas.
Short story is that you think community policing is being hurt by this?
I just threw it out there as a question, frankly. I just think that we need to take note of it, and we need to be prepared somehow as a city to, will we have another Freddie Gray incident? All the police are concerned about the next viral video of their misbehavior. And, I can't help but think that if there is a dicey situation in Congress Heights, a young white officer rolls up to deal with it, that might not be the best way to handle it and keep the peace and keep it calm and not have it, grow into something that is unseemly.
Well, let's put that question to the person who's running the department then. What do you see in what Harry's describing here?
So I'll say, first of all, when I read the article, I was a little surprised that Harry highlighted the things that are opposite of what all the other major publications have highlighted. The Metropolitan Police Department was highlighted in two significant articles in the past year. The New York Times, as well as Governing Magazine, noted that we were the only major city police department that had a department that reflected the racial makeup of our community. So we are far ahead of many of the other cities that are referenced in Harry's article. Has the population and the representation of the police department changed? Yes, they have. Still, we're overrepresented by African American officers in our police department, not underrepresented.
Let's just be clear for a stat. Let's just the Census Bureau says now the African American population of the city is like 49.5% or something like that, and the number 55% African American in the police department.
Yeah, so we still have an overrepresentation of African American. I also was a little surprised that Harry wouldn't highlight some of the efforts we've made to really significantly try and recruit just our D.C. high school students. We created a public safety academy. I've been working on that for years to kind of have a pipeline, like a vacation school for just D.C. residents to come through high school and have that public safety academy experience. I started the cadet program back that had been cut from funding for many, many years. I have 35 cadets that I can now 30 of them are paid for out of my budget, because I took it out of the budget and put it aside. But we get private funding from the Police Foundation for 5 additional cadets. So these are all D.C. high school students. They're born and raised here. They graduate from D.C. high schools. In fact, all but I think 3 of my current cadets are African American. The other 3 are Latino.
So that raises the question that you basically agree with me, that we need to have more African. No, you're stating the case. My case, you just said it. You're attempting to increase the number of African American officers from the District of Columbia, when in fact the numbers are just the opposite. The numbers of black officers are plummeting, and the number of white officers are going up. So I don't care what other cities are doing. Other cities are trying to, increase the number increase diversity.
Because they're so far behind.
And we're in this city going in the opposite direction.
Well, because they're so far behind, quite frankly. They're overrepresented by 20% to 40% against African Americans. But I'm always going to try and get our homegrown local kids on the police department. I've been doing that since I came on. And to argue that someone like Diane Grooms, who is arguably one of the most popular and effective police officials in the city, came from Pennsylvania. She originally came from Pennsylvania.
I don't think it's disqualifying, but
I don't think so either.
Lowell Duckett, you raised your hand a moment ago.
I'm listening to somewhat of a discord.
Way too
right
polite
here
for this.
But
program.
How did we get there with that high percentage? When I joined the police department, there were a total of 325 black officers on the whole job.
When did you join the department?
1968-69. Okay. We formed a Black Police Association to push that number. But we never went for the percentage in terms of, is it going to be 60, 40, whatever. We wanted an equal playing field. We wanted more women in law enforcement. And that's why I'm very proud and happy to see Chief Lanier, because she came through after we filed several lawsuits. Attorney Phyllis Outlaw was attorney for record, and complaints with the Office of Human Rights in D.C. We had to change the promotional process, the hiring process, the assignment process. At one time, a black officer couldn't ride in a patrol car except for the patrol wagon.
Nor could women.
And women could only work in criminal investigation division and youth division. And we fought for that. Now here we are. 2016, is the playing field level? Just about. Are we looking forward in the future? Quality officers stepping out of that car, whether they be black or white.
Well, are you concerned about the fact that the percentages of African Americans on the police department is heading towards, not being the majority any longer? Does that concern you at all, or does that not really?
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. What concerns me, whether that cop is black or white, when he steps out of that car, he's a professional. That's my main concern. I shared a story with you about Mike Douglas, who's an Irish-American. The day a tear came out of my eye when he finally learned what policing was all about. A lady's house had got broken into, a senior citizen, broke in the back door. She had no way to protect herself. The next day, on his time, he went and fixed the door, replaced the window, and got the lady another TV. I'm a preacher, so I'm going to naturally pound on something.
Yes, but remember, this is not Sunday morning, though, so
okay.
We only have a certain
okay,
amount of time.
Hey, look, I'm sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
If you want to join our conversation
about... And no collection plate.
If you want to join our conversation about race and policing, you can give us a call at 800-433-8850. You can tweet us at Kojo Show. Email us at kojo@wamu.org. Right now, we're going to take a call from Matthew in the District of Columbia. Matthew, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me. My name is Matthew Mull. I am the head of the police union. And I kind of wanted to call in. I know we're talking about race, and I think the chief brought up some attrition facts as well. But I think we're right on track. As the chief stated, we're about 55% African American, 35% white, and then about 10% Hispanic or Asian Pacific and that sort of stuff. I think where the biggest disparity is right now, it's between the male and female population. Maybe if my facts are correct, about 80% male, about 20% female on the department.
Chief is nodding her head yes.
We have her between 21% and 23%, so that is still a struggle, but we're still double national average.
Right. So I mean, we're right in there. I think if we can get our number of female officers up, that would be great for the city. But beyond that, I think the chief touched base about the cadet program and hiring local police officers. That's where I think we're struggling at an agency right now. We're talking about retention. I mean, we're in the retirement bubble. We knew we were going to be there. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot we can do. The mayor and the chief have some pretty good initiatives coming out, revamping the senior police officer program. I'm working with FIRE to try and institute a deferred retirement option program. But we have to remember, these are the things only keeping our experience. We have to keep experienced officers, because if you get too young of a department, I think that's where we fall into trouble. We lose all of that experience.
Sergeant Maul, this is Tom Sherwood. To you and the chief to address the Jeffrey Anderson story in the Washington City paper, said that since 2014, 851 sworn officers have either retired, resigned, or been terminated or died. The story suggests that one of the issues is not people retiring because of the bubble, but because policing has changed so much that they don't feel that they can do the job that they think they should do as police officers.
Well, Chief? Let me jump in real quick, because
you read that article.
The article is so full of just misleading and inaccurate facts. First of all, he repeatedly refers to 3,500 officers. Our sworn strength is 3,730. It's not 3,500. He also says that it's rare for a 20-year veteran to stick around. Well, 29% of my force has more than 20 years on, so that's just not true.
One-third.
And then resignations. The way he couches resignations versus retirements, he adds multiple years and aggregates the number. The bottom line is, in 2013, the year he refers to, as 153 people resigned, it's actually 66. 66, not 153. 66 of 200. So it's a very misleading article. And, you know, there was, Ferguson has made a change to playing field. It has changed the look and feel of our profession. Not only did Ferguson, but in early 2014, there was an arbitration decision that said that the union's fight to add more pay raises to the last contract had died. It was, and there were people waiting around to see if there was going to be another pay raise come. So those things all play a factor. I think this is a tough time to be a police officer. We've got to hang on to the good cops that we have, and we're doing everything we can to hang on to them.
So, Harry Jaffe again, with all due respect to the cadet school, which I think is a great idea, it doesn't start until next school year, if I'm not mistaken. I mean,
The Public Safety Academy?
Right.
Well, we run a cadet program year-round.
Right, but the Public Safety Academy, which is going to be in Anacostia High School, starts next school year. So that's not going to have an impact for 3, 4, or 5 years. You say, Chief, that you're pleased that the demographics of the police department match the demographics of the District of Columbia, but you don't deploy by race and color. So, you know, you're clearly going to have more Caucasian police officers up in predominantly African American neighborhoods, Clay Terrace, Congress Heights, and the like. Do you see that as a problem?
It hasn't been. I mean, I will deploy. There's not just race. There's also ethnicity issues here, right? So we have a very diverse police department and a very diverse city. So I will deploy people with language skills. There are certain areas of the city where we know we have a higher Spanish-speaking population, or a certain area of the city that has a higher Asian population. So I do try and deploy ethnicity into some of this factor, but race really doesn't seem to be an issue for us in terms of, I think Lowell hit it on the head. You know, he policed our city a long time. People that interact with police officers want one thing and one thing only, a police officer that is fair and professional. They really don't care about anything else. As long as you are part of my community, you are fair in the way you police, and you're professional, people don't really care. And
Sergeant Maul, if you're still there.
Let me interject one thing, because you brought up the police cadet program. Mm-hmm. And a lot of guys that police with me came through the police cadet program, but you got the union president on the line. What we did in the black community, Sergeant Benjamin Ash, Sergeant Buddy Smallwood, we just buried him 2 weeks ago. We opened up a gym. Boxing, karate, weightlifting, powerlifting. Guess how many young men became police officers because cops took the time to train with them? Over 75. One of them is the commander of this district we're sitting in right now. He came through that program. Now, we were rough on him, but we took our time to stop and grab some of these at-risk kids and say, hey, come on down to the gym. Let's put on some gloves. Let me teach you how to really fight instead of walking around with a gun in your hand. Mm-hmm. So, bringing back the cadet program, that's an excellent idea. Going into the high schools, that's an excellent idea. I used to teach across at UDC. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked and dismayed at the number of kids that were getting criminal justice degrees that were not going to qualify to become a police officer. Bad credit, no driving record, drug usage. So why are you sitting there wasting 4 years of your life and you're not going to be a police officer because you don't meet the minimum standards? You see where I'm going?
Sergeant Maul, if you're still there, we got an email from John that I'd like to bounce off of both you and the chief. John writes, if black officers are currently 55% of the current force, then that's an overrepresentation of black officers in comparison of the population. I agree we should have more officers from D.C. Otherwise, I really don't see the issue here. Oh, yeah, I'm a black man from Southeast D.C. Chief Lanier, you first.
Thank you, John.
Okay, Sergeant Maul, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I don't really have too much more to say on that. I mean, I think our numbers are right in line of where we should be. I mean, I don't think race or gender should be the issue in this. I think we need to figure out ways to deal with retention.
Sergeant Maul, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it.
One thing does matter is the money. I reported on when the arbitrator ruled and there was no back pay for the officers. You know, Chief, you're the head of the department. You get blamed for that because the mayor and the council and the city didn't stand up for the officers, for the first responders, and give them more money. Now, what is the salary like in the district compared to, say, Fairfax County or Montgomery County?
We have not only one of the highest starting salaries, we have the best benefits. I mean, our retirement's phenomenal. Lowell here he's getting his retirement. You just look at the people we police alongside, the Park Police, the Capitol Police, all those federal agencies, their retirement's like 35, 38%. Mm-hmm. We can walk out the door with 82% of our salary. Right?
So money is not an issue.
Money. Our starting salary is $53,000 a year, and at the end of your first year, you're up almost $60,000 a year. And there's unlimited overtime in our department because court and all the reimbursable details and special events. Most officers, I think, the thing that they really want is they want good schedules. You know, young cops in particular, they have their weekends off. You know, they like to be able to...
The millennials.
Yes. I mean, and that's cited all through Jeff Anderson's article. And I agree. I like weekends off, too. But guess what? I'm working this weekend. It's part of what we do. And we try and maximize, the younger officers. We're looking at 410 shifts and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, we got to work weekends.
One thing I want to ask you about Jeff Anderson's article, just out of morbid curiosity, because he tweeted this to us earlier today. He said that a source from the police department told him that Washington City paper was blocked on department computers yesterday and that people in the department weren't able to read his article. Is that true?
We don't. Actually, I saw that. So first thing I did was have somebody out in the district's check before I responded to you. Stranger things have happened. But no, the only people that have the ability to, I actually called the city's chief technology officer. The only people that have the ability to block things on our computer is the Octo. And they do block.
That's the Office of Technology.
They do block sites, but they do not block any media sites. And I had several different people try and log in from several different places. We found no place in MPD where that article couldn't be raised. I will say our internet was down for several hours this morning, but was up and running yesterday.
Okay, I just got back from China where I wasn't able to Google or read the New York Times for a week. But anyway, Harry Jeffy, I think, has a question.
So I hate to keep being the fly in the ointment, but crime seems to be up in various parts of the district. Certainly homicides are up. Certainly they're up by huge amounts in numbers in Ward 7. Do you think that the changing complexion of the police department has any effect on that, number one? Number two, are you reconsidering your decision to disband the vice squads?
So two things. One is, do I think the race makeup of the department has any impact on the increase in homicides in Ward 7? No.
In general across the city?
No. I mean, I don't think the police force is the racial makeup of the police force has an impact on, you know, specific crime issues in the areas of the city. And what was your second question?
About vice squads.
The vice squads.
You kind of eliminated several of the specialty squads and just have officers being officers.
It's so funny because years ago, I think in 2008 or 2009, I disbanded the centralized narcotics unit and pushed all these vice units out to all the districts, and everybody complained. You can't do that, Chief. You can't get rid of the centralized vice unit. That's an important role, right? But when I wanted to pull those vice units into a centralized unit to give them advanced training like the new CIU has and the gun unit has and all that other stuff so we'd have a more highly trained force, everybody said the same thing. You can't do that, Chief. You can't do that. So, I mean, in terms of the ability for those officers that were doing individual vice operations in the districts. Now in the Major Narcotics Branch, they're doing them with the gun unit and with the CIU, the Criminal Investigations Unit, and getting phenomenal training along with our crime suppression teams, which are still in the districts, all seven districts. The number of drug arrests outside of marijuana has not suffered. So we have a very strong drug enforcement effort that goes on. We make a lot of drug arrests, unfortunately. So I don't think there's a decision. I don't think it was a bad decision. I think in terms of how we do drug investigations now is very different than it was in the 90s. And it required them to get some more advanced training in terms of social media and in right. terms of new types of drugs in the markets that we're facing.
Agreed. But vice squads are more than drug prevention, drug arrests. The vice squads, from my recollection and my understanding, are units that are often plain clothes, or often in the districts, often getting to understand who's doing what to whom. I mean, I'll put it to Lowell Duckett, but what's your sense of
he ran
of
a
vice?
Great vice.
Well, of course he did, and it wouldn't be there anymore. Hey, go ahead.
Well, the bottom line was, on the flip side of that, the Delta unit eventually became the gang unit. And we were very aggressive and in your face. When I got assigned to Chief Soulsby's office, I was asked to look at all seven district vice units, their casual clothes squads, the motorized squads, and NSID. When I got that data together, the number of arrests, the number of guns recovered, the number of narcotics recovered, I recommended, and everybody looked at me like, that can't be Lieutenant Duckett, that we start to disband some of those units.
So you agree with the
that
chief?
That report was done in 1996-97.
So you're not busting on the chief today for her disbanding these various vice units?
No, I want to rag on these guys going out there charading like they're doing their jobs, because at the end of the day, it boils down to data.
Mm-hmm.
When you were in the Delta unit, you come in, we're going to have one gun, four bodies, and a little bit of dope. And you call yourself a vice unit? No, that's not a vice unit.
Chief Lanier is nodding her head.
What about, Chief, the overall sense?
And I just want to say this, too. You have to make sure that when you're doing drug investigations, the drug market has changed dramatically. Lowell was running a drug unit when we had 200-300 open-air drug markets across the city and very, very violent environments around those. We're dealing with a different type of drug and a different type of drug dealing, and you got to approach that differently. It's a little bit more complicated investigation, takes a little more time and different tools, and you got to have strong management. Just jumping out on people and putting them up against the wall and saying you're a vice unit, that's not going to work in today's environment. We're not talking about open air markets.
What about the general fear? Harry touched on this. The general concern of people that crime seems to be on the rise. All the statistics can argue one way or the other about this, but whether And I know you don't. You're not the rape on Metro was not an issue, but it's the rape on Metro, it's the stabbing or the shooting of the person at Deanwood, don't meant Metro. But the crimes around the city, Ward 7 certainly got trouble. The assaults on people up near Friendship Heights, wherever around the city, people feel like we're starting a bubble more of new crime. You recognize that, I think, but then what do you get to do about it?
I do think, and we saw it last year, and it's very troubling. You know, I've had a series of meetings in the past couple of weeks even where meeting with hospitals, where the hospitals are saying, hey, we're seeing extreme uptick in violent people coming in here into the emergency room, doctors getting assaulted, getting injured. They're seeing it in cities all across America.
Are these people on drugs at the time or just people violent?
I asked that question in a meeting the other day at one of the hospitals. I said, how many of this uptick they reported where the doctors are being attacked and injured over the past year, how many of those do you think are attributed to drug use? And they said about two-thirds. So there's still something else going on. There's something else going on when you look at incidents we have, and it's not just kids, it's not just adults, it's not any one, you know, thing you can point your finger to, but there is a different tone. And just look at the incidents on Metro, look at the incidents involving large groups of kids fighting and social media videotaping beatings of other kids and things like that. Something is different, and it's troubling, and we're really struggling to figure out what is the origin of this, change in the mentality about just lack of respect for other people out in our community.
Ooh.
At the end of the City Paper article, Sergeant Mall said that you've had a great run, and that he expected you to look for another job. What's your response to that?
Well, he didn't say he expects me to look for another job.
He said.
He didn't say it was time for her to go.
It was a little softer than that. Are you there?
I think he's still on.
What did you say?
I'm still on the line. So a lot of that article took a little bit of what I said out of context. When I made that comment, we were talking about the chief and our relationship, and we have had since April 1st an absolutely great relationship. I was using some statistical facts that she has long outlived, you know, her legacy on a police department as a major metropolitan chief. So a little bit of that was taken out of context.
Yeah, the fact is, you said the chief would like to get this handle on this current rising crime and then make an exit. And that makes sense, I guess.
I am no different than any other metropolitan police officer. The true, the true metropolitan police officers are always metropolitan police officers. And we love the city. We love our department. And absolutely, I want to see this. The issue with these emerging violent crime trends go the other way. I want to see this city, whenever I leave here, the great city that it is, and have it be seen that way by everybody else. I love this department, and I love this city. And so there's nothing wrong with Matt saying, you know, I would like to see that before I go. I have a job right now, so I'm not looking for one. But, yes, I would like to see that.
One last question. Summer crime initiative.
I thought you were going to ask her if she would do the cannonball.
Well, that's an important question, too. Let's get the crime question out of the way first. What are your plans for the summer? School's going to get out in a couple of weeks.
Yes, we started a summer crime initiative back May 1st. So we are in full swing now in summer crime initiative. We are in five particular areas more so than others, but we are doing citywide summer crime initiative this year. So, so far we've got it going in the right directions in most areas. We've got a real challenge in Ward 7, and we're going to stay on that.
And the cannonball.
And the cannonball. I can do a cannonball.
Is that a commitment?
I can do a cannonball.
All right. Tom Sherwood can be there with a smartphone.
I think you should hold hands going into the pool.
If you're tough enough for a cannonball, you're tough enough for a tattoo.
Kathy Lanier, thank you so much for making time for us today. Lowell Duckett, thank you so much for making time for us today.
Glad to see you, Chief.
Harry Jaffe, one half of the greatest reporting duo in local D.C. politics history, Dream City, Race, Power, and the Decline of Washington, D.C. Thank you for joining us.
Humbling.
We say for Memorial Day, the Memorial Day is to honor the people who have died in our wars. Veterans Day is to honor all people who have served. Don't get them confused this weekend.
Thank you, Tom, and we'll see you next week. That's it for the show today. But remember, we've got lots more for you online. Head to kojoshow.org to explore the show archives, including shows that drive home the meaning of Memorial Day, like a conversation with Roger Lewis about the art of memorials, which are a common sight in and around the district, and a discussion with writer Robert Poole about Section 60, the area at Arlington National Cemetery where many service members from Iraq and Afghanistan have been laid to rest. Remember, you can take the show with you via your favorite podcast app. And however you listen, be sure to meet us back here Tuesday at noon after the Memorial Day weekend. It's when Metro's SafeTrack maintenance plan starts. We'll consider what it means for your daily commute. Plus, iconic consumer advocate and one-time presidential candidate Ralph Nader is in the studio. Until then, I'm Michael Martinez sitting in for Kojo Nnamdi. Thanks so much for listening.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Nnamdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.